Hi, I'm Maeve Doyle with the Art and Mayfair podcast, and we're at Sladmore. Sladmore have been supporters from the start, and the start was 6 years ago, but this is the first time we've had Johnny Hawks on the sculpture trail. It's really nice talking to you in a gallery full of beautiful sculpture. It's also an inspiring location to speak to you. Hi, Johnny Hawks.
Hi, nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. I get to pass Sphelix, your incredible sphere and helix, perfect shape, almost every morning on my way into work. And it honestly makes me consider the beauty of curves.
That's great to hear, because it is. It's a wonderful shape. And it's an enigma on the curve, because as you look at it, it's completely all curve. You can't see its bends, curves, and it's just an exquisite shape, really. But it's an enigma because it's actually made with a straight line, and yet you can't see the straight line in it.
I'm not letting you end the sentence there. Unpack that.
Well, how it started was a great friend of mine, Dave Constable. He taught me all the moldings and things, how to make molds and how to cast things in his workshop in Olympia, David Constable, and he's a really good mate. And then in the very late 70s, we came across a casting that had a thermal shock in it, a resin casting, and they suffer from exotherm. And this exciting little crack, rather like a sort of Christmas decoration, was in this see-through ball. Well, it wasn't a ball, it was actually just a square, but it gave us this idea, and we started to work and think about how it would be really cool if we got the whole of the helix into a shape as such. And then we decided to make the shape a sphere. And then I worked out the sort of the maths involved in this and how we could go about it. And then we made an old jig system, because I'm also a furniture maker. I've been using my hands all my life, ever since I left school. And we bought an Archimedean screw.
What's an Archimedean screw?
An Archimedean screw is like a really old 19th century drill thing. But it has a long pitch on it, and that's what I was looking for. Rigged up all this jig head and everything, and then one night we basically shaped the Sphelix. And when we got it and then took it apart, and I'd say it was just a total eureka moment, really. We thought, this is absolutely fantastic.
You work in wood?
Yeah.
And the piece outside Fenix is wood?
No,
so it's
not
cast.
At all. It is absolutely cast. It's GRP, which is glass reinforced plastic. And the Sladmore have been wonderful. They also make them in bronze. I have made them in wood, but you can make them in wood and stone, but it's incredibly labor intensive. It's like you've got to sort of nearly hand carve it.
Let's go back to you and how this started. What was your early life like? How did you know you were going to work with your hands? Or did you know you were going to work with your hands for your entire life?
Yeah, I've always had an affinity with it. Certainly, I was pretty mischievous at school and got sent to the woodworking shop and that kind of thing. So I didn't really pay attention to the academic side of things. And yeah, I've always loved and been fascinated at how things are made, whether it's industrial processes, castings, or whether it's handcrafted. And I've just gone that way, really. I've got a natural bent to it. And I've had washing up jobs and worked in hotels and stuff like that when I was a teenager. But as soon as I left school, I got offered a job at Edward Barnsley. Wood is my real love affair. I absolutely adore wood because it's a material, unlike plastic or stone, which are very beautiful in their own right, but they're a bit inert. You know, stone isn't quite as bad, but metals are fairly, once you know, one metal isn't like the next metal, but the, you know, if you talk about molybdenum or you're talking about lead, they're, you know, lead is lead kind of thing. Whereas wood, each piece is alive, and it's great in a sense, because you work your life at it, and then it turns around and you make a beautiful table and it cracks and you get a kick up the arse and remind who's in charge, really. Nature's in charge. Bang on. You got it. And I've set up different workshops and companies, and I used to have a commercial because I thought, Christ, this isn't going to really pay all the bills. the art side of what I do. And I didn't want to do sculpture, although I've done it ever since sort of that high, which doesn't work on radio.
I can help you with that.
Yeah.
That high is about half a person size.
Yeah. So I've always done it. I've always been fascinated. My mum and dad encouraged me. My sister was artistic. And I've lost the track of what I was saying.
That's all right. I'm picking it up. These are your influences, the things that sort of kept you going. And I think when you have a family that's creative, it's easier to forge a life. I think it's hardest for people whose family tell them they can't make a living as an artist.
Yeah.
And how, and that's part of the beauty of living in Britain, and I'd say certainly London, is that people understand that an artist's life isn't one about being poor and struggling, that there are vibrant careers you can have.
Yeah, absolutely. And but going back, I didn't want the commercial side of wanting to try and, you know, make a living out of sculpture. So I chose furniture, which is
a type of sculpture.
The furniture I make is pretty sculptural, and it certainly has it, but it's easier to sell it in a sense, you know. And I didn't want that pressure of directing what I was doing. So although I made a few sculptures within that period, I guess from when I was age 25 through to, you know, 55, I wasn't really doing that. I was more interested in one-off pieces of, you know, super bespoke furniture.
I think the world has caught up with you too. I think certainly this idea between craft and art is being blurred.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, I think of Ron Arum.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's a fantastic designer. I love his work. He influenced most furniture makers. He's a great architect as well.
You know,
he's
industrial designer.
Stuff. Yeah. And you're right, the blurring, because when I was growing up, fine art was considered, which was basically defined as painting and sculpture, as important, whereas decorative art or craft, you know, it went sort of fine art, decorative art, craft. And craft was seen, yeah, and then the Crafts Council certainly helped in that direction, putting it forward. But I was never, because I went to art school, but I dropped out after 6 weeks.
What art school?
I went to Ravensbourne School of Art and Design, which was basically Bromley Polytechnic.
And 6 weeks, you were like, I'm...
Yeah, I'm out of it. I looked forward to going there so much because I thought school was just shit, if I'm being honest. And I used to really muck about doing the school bookie and being that kind of thing and just hustling a bit. So I couldn't wait to go to art school. And when I finally got there, I just thought I was sort of, well, they made you make the first week or second week or something. We were making little, you know, when you cut out bits of paper with flaps on it and you join them up into plutonic solids, squares. I thought, Christ, I was doing this when I was 9.
Well, I think you probably made the right choice. And also the solutions to your work was more work.
Yeah.
It sounds like your process is your practice.
Yeah.
And you would learn more in the studio than you would in a classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I enjoy. I really enjoy the making process. And so I'm considered an outsider artist.
Great.
Which is a weird kind of thing, but it doesn't bother me one little bit, to be honest, because I think that not being formally trained stops you being, you know, following these fairly tight paths that they seem to, you know, sometimes launch into. Whereas I generate and become inspired by what's happening around me. And the Slabmore put on a show for me in 2020. The work that was in there was some of the sculptures were in there about the emotions that you feel. I mean, I got a, you know, really happy marriage, got a wonderful wife and 4 kids, and, you know, they're wonderful, but they give you absolute grief.
The price of loving them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's some of those emotions that went in, and that's what I like working with. If I'm not going to feel about it, then I'm not really going to get excited enough to sort of, my process is to take ideas. And the two big pieces that I've got that are only in maquette form at the moment, they are Nothing Weighs More Than Everything, and the other one is called What Is Enough? And I think that's just a fascinating question, because it's never been a problem to civilization and society, but it is now, because it's very much, we have the capacity, there's too many of us, and our striving to better, to get more is DNA'd into us, basically. You want more for your kids, you want more for this. You're always going out there looking. And that increase and desire for more is the very thing that's going to nuke us. You know, we're not going to be able to sustain that. And these are all big questions, but they're the kind of things that's in my head. I'm a daydreamer, total daydreamer. I sit there like, you know, I'm not a great reader. I will sit there for hours just like looking a bit blank, to be honest. But
it's like a meditation for you.
Yeah, kind of.
And
then
the
you
environment.
Take these ideas and you just slowly then think, well, how am I going to abstract that and put it into a physicality?
I don't have to ask you what your studio practice is because I think you've just covered it. But I did want to mention Konstantin Brancusi.
Love him. Love him. I think he's absolutely great. I loved his minimalism, really. Just fantastic shapes. I think if you're going to work in those sort of shapes, it's the show I had with the Slabman was called Chasing the Line. And I think that's what it's about, basically. If you're going to go for those paired off, Dashwood has it in his, if you see his work, he took the feathers off, which is what Edouard Sandoz did. He took the feathers off bird sculptures. And once you've got that sort of perfect form, the curve's got to be right, particularly if it's a geometric piece. Noam Garbo, I think.
Exactly. I was just going to say Noam Garbo, and then I was going to say Ishmael Noguchi.
Yeah. Fantastic. Georgie and I went to see his show in London, two, 3 years ago, the Barbican?
Yeah, it was great.
Christ. And we went to Japan to see his studio.
Did you?
Wow.
And that
absolutely
ties in
great.
A little
I
bit.
I snuck around the back and tried to get into somebody where his huge, big sores. I mean, he had hundreds of people in there.
I think, though, he reminds me a bit of Art Mayfair because he wanted his sculpture to be public. He wanted people playing on it.
He wanted people to get... He designed playgrounds. I mean, you know, he was famous for it, and so he should be. I mean, he's a fantastic artist and sculptor and, yeah.
That's what
real
I think
big
of
influence.
When I see Felix outside Fenix, I think of those masters, Noam Garbo, Konstantin Brancusi, Ishmael Noguchi.
Yeah.
So what is art for, in your opinion?
Oh, it's such a great question, isn't it? I think it just makes us happy or sad. It gives us emotion. You know, my view is on doing my work personally is that I don't really give a hoot what people think about it, but it's just if you walk on by and you haven't noticed it, I've simply failed. When you notice it, what your reaction is, you know, is entirely down to you. So... But it's been around ever since we've been human beings, you know, as we came out of the soup and the blob and worked our way up into the beings that we are now. We've put drawings on caves. We need it. We don't know why we need it, but we just need it. And I think it's going to become a really fascinating question, and more than a question, when the interplay starts coming in with AI. Because although you've got, there's a couple of AI robots that actually make, on the critical side, fairly okay art, it's more the sort of intellectualizing and the thinking that goes into, you know, what do AI think of abstract thought? You know, when you ask them what color the wind is and stuff like that, does the smoke start coming out of them? I've no idea. I'm not really. But I feel there's going to be a dialogue there that artists are going to have a strong input into where AI, or not where it goes, that's presumptuous, but what, you know, I think it can ask it questions. Because I think it's a blitzingly human thing, art, that you could totally turn around and say there's no purpose in it whatsoever. And if, you know, dictatorships start to rise up with the sort of death of democracy, because choice is surely one of the most expensive things on the planet. You know, the fact you've got 3 avocados on the shelf, there's no need for it, but there still are. And the fact that we have freedom, we have choice. So eventually, as things start to crash, then, you know, 100 years or whatever, when that choice won't be there, dictatorships will rise up because democracies won't be affordable. And then where is art then? I think it becomes more important. I think, you know, and you see that all the struggling in war-torn Ukraine now, they're still out there doing it. You know, it's not subject to, or it's massively influenced by what's going on around it, but it doesn't cease. It never ceases.
If you could live with one piece of work, what would it be and why? And money is not the deciding factor.
Oh, I'd really go for Umberto Boccioni. He's an Italian futurist. He sadly died in 1916. He never made very many pieces of sculpture. He also painted. But he's just a fantastic artist, one of the daddies of modern art. And his piece, which is a beast of a name, of the continuity of space and something like that, but it's in the Tate. If you
the like, unique form of continuity in space.
Yeah.
And it's at Tate Britain.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's so the opposite of the smooth, beautiful.
Absolutely. It doesn't have that geometric shape. It has abstract, it has form, really. It's quite a figurative piece in a sense. It's been slightly pulled.
It's antagonistic, where yours are so calming. Yeah.
Yes, I mean, it is a difference to the sort of purity of the Sphelix and the form of the Sphelix, which, you know, we were terribly inspired when we put it together, that it's a very strong symbol for anti-racism. And it shows the sort of joining of communities. And the sculpture itself is, you only ever get half of it, really. So that you've got to imagine, either you want to turn it into a sphere or you can turn it into sheer space, dream space. It doesn't matter. But the beauty is just in those purity of lines. And I don't think that ever make anything quite as pure as that again, to be honest. It's just too tough an act to follow, because it's quite like the dynamics of just a cube, a rectangle, a sphere, and a triangle.
Living in harmony in this Felix.
Yeah.
Is there anything you want to say that I haven't asked you about regarding Art in Mayfair, the sculpture trail, Felix?
Yeah, I think sculpture trails, and I think what you're doing, Art in Mayfair, I think sculpture trails themselves is a great way for the public to engage in art, because I think you're loose. You might have come out of a bar, you're walking to a place, and it's that looseness that's exciting. You know, art, if it hits you, is breathtaking. It nearly gives you a heart attack. And if it's not giving you a heart attack, you probably, you know, you're not interacting with that piece. And you know, it's like a love affair. It's like when you see the most beautiful woman, boy, whatever, dog. If it's constricting, physically constricting, you should be short of breath. And I think that the sculpture trail offers that opportunity.
Thank you, Johnny Hawkes. I encourage everyone to look at his work on the Art in Mayfair website and see Johnny's work. And thank you for the time today.
That's it.
Thank you, Johnny Hawkes.
Thank you.